This week, we've been looking at concepts of leadership and justice, leadership and service. And today, we're going to look at the concept of prophetic leadership. What's been working, and I think I'd like to sort of stick with it, would be to present about 20 to 25 minutes of material, and then to begin a conversation around that. I have learned that as part of the Holden community's charm and characteristic that we're never short on good things to talk about. So help me carry the load for the second half here as we when we open it up. Okay, I'm going to use the overhead projector and share a few concepts around leadership, and then in about 20-25 minutes we'll open it up. I'd like to suggest for starters that as we look at leadership, I like to, for my own sake, try to simplify things as much as possible. So I'm going to suggest, based on all of the leadership books that have been written in the last decade or so, leadership of this, leadership of that, that in all of that, there's really only three types of leadership. And everything else sort of falls under these categories. The first type is transactional leadership. And notice the line that separates that from the other two. A second type is transformational leadership. And the third type sounds a lot like it, and we'll come back to distinguish it, transforming leadership. The first thing I'd like to say about transactional leadership, and then sort of leave it behind, is that I don't think that it's really leadership. I think that it's essentially management. But it's a big problem, because I think throughout our university system in particular, in business schools, but in a whole wide cross-section of the ways in which we prepare professionals, we essentially prepare them to act as transactional leaders. Transactional leaders do this. Transactional leaders simply maintain the status quo for a chosen few. Whether lawyers or accountants or teachers, the goal of transactional leadership is to keep things just the way they are. Dwayne has been offering some wonderful Bible studies this week on the prophets. And in the day of the prophets, when we read about Micah and Amos and Hosea, it's important to note that while those folks were doing their prophecy work, that there were paid prophets in the land. Luckily, Micah and Amos and Hosea were not paid prophets. They were volunteers. If you were a paid prophet, what would you be tempted to prophesy?
Whatever was ever paying you wants to hear.
Whatever the person was paying you, most likely the king, wanted to hear. That's essentially transactional leadership. Transactional leadership is the dominant form of leadership, and the image of the dollar bill and the sort of institution that it represents and the helicopter circling around it is, my image is some sort of defense of that dollar bill, has a lot to say about what transactional leadership is ultimately about. And it's important to note that it's the dominant form of leadership. When we read about leadership, probably about 80 to 90% of the books written on leadership are about transactional leadership. But as we talk about prophetic leadership, the purpose of today's, this afternoon's time together, transactional leadership is not a form of leadership, and only the last two will serve us well. So let's take a look at transformational leadership. Transformational leadership, as opposed to transactional, is intended to change the status quo for the common good. One of the ways to do that, and transformational leadership is about that, is speak the truth in love to power. Speak the truth in love to power. When there was starvation in Goshen, God probably sent people to Goshen to minister to those who were starving. But he also sent Moses to Pharaoh to say, "Let my people go." Not with hate, not with scorn, but with clear intent, "Let my people go," speaking the truth in love to power. Okay, we're going to come back to transformational leadership in a bit. But let's just compare that quickly with transforming leadership. Transforming leadership is akin to transformational leadership. It seeks the same goal, that is, improving life for the common good. But transforming leadership is a mutually transformative process that seeks to raise one another to higher levels of motivation and morality. An image of this for me is Mother Teresa. She very rarely goes to companies that could feed the poor in Calcutta and asks them to change their habits and to become more just in the distribution of food. But through her actions, through ministering to those who are dying, trying to give them dignity in their last days, I think she has lifted all of our hearts to higher levels of motivation and morality. Okay, so let's just take a look at those two together, then, the two forms of leadership that I think really are leadership, transformational and transforming. Transformational leadership, this is some important distinctions, is the status quo. Focus is the status quo. You're trying to zero in on what is, naming it as a problem, and the purpose is to, in light of that, focusing in on the status quo, the intention is to promote justice and equality and fair treatment, etc. And the goal, again, is to speak the truth in love to power. Transforming leadership tries to get at the philosophical assumptions of the status quo that might be individualism. If you saw that wonderful movie Wall Street in the 1980s, you remember that one, that line from Wall Street? What was it? Greed is good. Greed is good. Remember that? And so one of the philosophical assumptions behind a market economy status quo is that greed is good. The purpose of transforming leadership is to try to promote a change of heart and help us to understand that maybe generosity is better. And the goal is to articulate truth that unifies. And as I think about this, I think about Jesus. Never really confronting powers that be, but whether he was talking to a fisherman or a tax collector or a centurion or to Pilate, the goal was to try to articulate a truth that would unify. I am the bread of life. Not really trying to confront power as much as trying to appeal to people's hearts and appeal to our maybe deeper and better selves. Some images that help me, because I like symbolic language. When I think of transformational leadership, I think of justice, scales of justice. When I think of transforming leadership, it's this image of our hearts being lifted up for greater and greater callings in this world. My own belief is that both transformational and transforming leadership are essential if we're really going to change the status quo. One of the reasons why I believe that Martin Luther King was effective as a transforming leadership, as a transforming leader, was that Malcolm X was out there. So you had a choice to deal with Malcolm or to deal with Martin. And it was the fact that they were together working on behalf of racial justice that I think that we paid more attention to the issue of racial justice. But help me for a minute here. What I'd like to do is to explore a little bit more deeply transformational leadership. Transformational leadership, again, is about changing the status quo for the common good. So let's just be real generous to each other, because after all, you may have had, you know, a hard day with a hiker, just getting in the bus from Stehekin. So we'll be real generous. I want to try to understand transformational leadership in action, and I'd like you to help me name some. So could we just name three transformational leaders who lived in the last 2,000 years who tried to change the status quo for the common good? Could you name just three who tried in the last 2,000 years?
Thomas Paine.
Gandhi. I heard somebody say Thomas Paine.
Thomas Jefferson.
Jefferson.
Lincoln.
Okay. Who else?
Sojourner Truth.
Sojourner Truth. Let's name a few others.
Martin Luther.
I'm going to suggest, even though I said Martin Luther King was a transforming leader, I think he was actually both. So I'd like to add Martin Luther King to that list. Anyone else?
Romero.
Archbishop Romero. Okay, let's take a few examples of those to make some points. Archbishop Oscar Romero, Martin Luther King, and Gandhi. What happened to those three? They were killed and they were assassinated. What's the difference between that? When I sometimes work with young people, I hear they died. And we go, no. We all die. They were killed. But some said killed and some said assassinated. What's the difference between those two? I could be killed if Ed wasn't a good bus driver. I could be killed trying to cross the street and not watching for the bus. What's the difference?
It was intentional.
Yeah. Say some more about that.
Someone set out to kill both.
Yeah, think about it.
Stop the message.
Stop, okay, but I want you to just stay with that a little bit more. What sets out to kill transformational leaders?
Someone who doesn't want the status quo changed.
Okay, so the status quo itself is ultimately responsible for the death of many transformational leaders, okay? Now the good news is, because after all I'm promoting transformational leadership, the good news is not all transformational leaders are killed. The good news, but unfortunately, some of them are just tortured. Okay, who is Stephen Biko?
South Africa,
who died in prison from having been tortured over 5 to 6 years of his life. Some transformational leaders are just imprisoned for 28 years to be let out to become president of their country. Who is that? Nelson Mandela. Some people are excommunicated by the church and forgiven 486 years later because they thought that the earth revolved around the sun.
Galileo.
And a little encouragement from Copernicus. Some transformational leaders are just intentionally lied about. We leave them out of our history books. Some of you know a person named Rennie Golden. Does that ring a bell? She's been in the village several times. She's written a wonderful book called Dangerous Memories. I think that's such a powerful title, Dangerous Memories. And here's her assumption in the book, is that we intentionally don't tell the stories of some people in our history books because their memories are so dangerous that if we talked about them more often, we might be likely to imitate their behavior. So don't worry about this if you don't know the answer to this question, because it probably wasn't in your history books. American history now. Who is the Moses of her people?
Harriet Tubman.
Tell me the Harriet Tubman story.
Well, Harriet Tubman was actually a leader on the Underground Railroad of safely getting slaves to the north so that they would be free.
Okay. Harriet Tubman was born in North Carolina. She was a field slave and a house slave, and that was important because as a house slave, she was taught a little bit about reading and writing, and she also knew the routine of the plantation. She knew when people were going to be gone, and she knew when things would be a little slower. She was a field slave, so she knew where there were holes in the fence, if you will. She knew how things worked out in the field. And one day, evening as a matter of fact, she plotted her own escape and successfully did that, escaped to the north, and in the north married a free black man. Had her freedom, and she could have been content with that. But you see, there was something in her conscience because of she remembered who she was, just like Moses. Moses is in Pharaoh's court, and it's only until he remembers who he is, a slave. And the son of a slave. Again, the power of memory. Moses remembers who he is. Harriet Tubman remembers who she is. And in that process, they begin to commit themselves to transformational change. Harriet Tubman was so moved that she went back to the South and brought others back on the Underground Railroad. 17 times. She brought back over 250 people to freedom. And one of the things she was proudest of in her entire life is that she never lost a passenger. She became so effective at navigating at night by use of the stars that after she had done all of this for her people, the North hired her as a spy and a scout in the Civil War and led Northern troops into battle. Who knew that story? The belief is that there's hundreds of stories like that, but they conjure up dangerous memories. Some transformational leaders are killed, some are tortured, some are excommunicated by the church, some are forgotten by history, some are intentionally left out of our history books. So here is the $64,000 question, and I would like to hear from some of you. Knowing that it might cost you something, but that it will cost you something, why are you still willing to be a transformational leader? And I would like to hear from some of you. Yeah.
It has to be like the prophets. You have to feel called to it, that God expects that of you.
Okay. Just the prophets?
All of us are called.
Okay. So that it's part of our calling, you're suggesting?
Yes.
Okay. Olaf.
You believe that what you are...
Just a little louder.
You believe that your cause is right.
So
that is a counterbalance to the pressures to stop.
Okay, so that somehow your belief that your cause is right helps you to get past the inertia of the status quo. Can I just say one word about that, and then we'll come to your hand. And I'm trying to learn names. Your name is?
I'm Catherine.
Catherine, okay. Just back to Olaf's point for a second. If you believe you're right, here's what Dr. King and R. Buckminster Fuller had in common, okay? Dr. King, a devout Christian, R. Buckminster Fuller, a self-proclaimed agnostic, okay? Dr. King believed that the universe bent towards justice. Think about that. That the universe bent towards justice. What does that mean? It means that God has an intention in this world, and the universe, therefore, is not a neutral place. So even a little bit of action on behalf of justice, you're working in cooperation with the universe. That's not a bad teammate. And so if we can just get past that inertia a little bit, all sorts of things begin to fall into alignment. Why else could people like Dr. King and others sit at lunch counters in the South and get beat up with sticks and do nothing to defend themselves and do nothing in retaliation and believe that that would change the world? Only if you believe that the universe is not a neutral place is that possible. R. Buckminster Fuller, as an agnostic, said that he never once wrote for a grant, by the way. All the money, all the proceeds that he ever got to do his work, I would use the word providence, just sort of came his way, because he believed that the universe was a kind place. And that if he set out to live a life that was intended to improve the lot of life for those in the universe, that the universe in its goodness would find a way to take care of him. So, Olaf, I think that's a great point. If we believe that what we're doing is right, that'll get us past the inertia that the status quo sets up. Okay, Catherine.
As you're discussing this, and especially Harriet Tubman and what she was able to do, I think that she must have really had a sense of call. And there's a wonderful book written by a woman by the name, I think, Elizabeth O'Connor. It's called Cry Pain, Cry Hope. And in it, she says that unless we reach the point where we know where our pain comes from, that we're not able to receive our call. For instance, I know one woman who has set up a place for women who are abused in Walla Walla, Washington. And she has had a daughter who was in an abusive relationship, and this gave her a great deal of pain. So she literally has started this ministry for women who are in abusive situations.
Catherine, the whole group now is going to think that, you know, you were a plant and, you know, that we're really partners, because that both...
What's your name?
All right, I sense you have something in your hip pocket. That both transformational leadership and transforming leadership, and this has a lot to do with what Dwayne has been helping us with in Bible study all this week, to understand the prophets. Earlier in my life, and I think I've been working on these issues for at least a couple decades now, I found myself being very angry. Angry at those who abused the environment. Angry at those who mistreated people of color and women. Angry at those who were ignorant to the pain of classism. But Catherine is helping us to understand a different sort of moral motivation, and it's not anger, it's anguish. Okay? And here's what Walter Brueggemann, in a book entitled Prophetic Imagination, we're talking about prophetic leadership, says about the power of anguish. And when you think about this, I'd like you to think about the shortest verse in the Bible, Jesus wept. And that if you go back and take a look, and Brueggemann does a good job at this, each time Jesus seeks to heal, his first goal, his first process of centering himself is centering himself on the pain of others. And let's see what Brueggemann says about that. Brueggemann says that the status quo is dependent upon our numbness. Okay? That it is important for us to be numb to the pain of war. Otherwise, we wouldn't tolerate it. It is important for us to be numb to the injustice of CEOs making 430 times what the people on the factory floor make. Our numbness is absolutely essential. The status quo depends on it. And the status quo essentially tries to satiate us with good food, with entertainment in particular. The Romans called it bread and circuses. You know, keep them fed and keep them entertained, and the masses will stay out of our way and the empire can continue. But Brueggemann says the one thing they can't control is compassion. They cannot control anguish. So listen to this. The goal of prophetic imagination, prophetic leadership, is the replacing of numbness with compassion. That is the end of cynical indifference with the beginning of noticed pain. Thus, the stories, if seen as radical dismantling criticism, bring together the internalization of pain and the external transformation. Two more paragraphs, brief ones. Quite clearly, the one thing the dominant culture cannot tolerate or co-opt is compassion. The ability to stand in solidarity with the victims of the present order. It can manage charity and good intentions, but it has no way to resist solidarity with pain or grief. If groans were audible, they could be heard in the streets and markets and courts, then the consciousness of domination is already jeopardized. So, transformational leadership or transforming leadership, I used to approach with anger. It's my goal now to approach them with compassion and trying to be vulnerable to the world as I see it. Just two more pieces and then we'll stop for some broader discussion. When I was doing some research in leadership, I began to take a look at leadership education from about the 1920s in my research ended in 1985, and took a look at over 100 different titles of leadership. And if you have trouble sleeping, you know, come see me because I have some books that you ought to read. Between about 1920 and 1940, the dominant concept in books on leadership was the common good. That was the role of leaders, was to help us in community, whether in corporate setting or in political life or in religious life, to help us to be inspired to pursue the common good. That was the role of leadership, okay, the great society, all of that. In about 1940, until about 1980, there was a shift, and there was a new bottom line in the promotion of leadership. And if you take a look at titles, even book titles, between the 40s and about 1980, it's evident. What do you think the new bottom line is?
Success.
Success, but even more specific.
Dollar.
The dollar sign.
Well, it's an economic.
The dollar sign. Yeah, economic success. The book's written between 1940, and that's important because that's World War II, us gearing up for World War II, and all of the money that was made during World War II and the preparation to engage in that war. And then we come out of World War II, a highly industrialized society, the most powerful economy on the planet, and our prowess as a nation soars. And everything turns its attention to leadership and the what we know is the bottom line in this culture, and that is the dollar bill. What I think we've been in the process of doing in the last decade is to sort of reclaim the common good. We see it in a lot of titles, and my belief is that without a sense of spirituality in our leadership, we can't do that. But I'd like to end with this note as we think about leadership. I think that leadership really exists like three acts in a play. Act one, act two, and act three leadership. Act one leaders operate on the national and international scene and operate mostly through law, policy, philosophy, and diplomacy. Can you name a couple? Act one leaders?
Or your Congress.
Huh?
Congress.
Okay, can you name one?
Name a Congress or name a member.
Can you name a person as an Act One leader?
Slade Gordon.
Okay. And I think some of the silence is also telling, okay? Act Two leaders operate on the local and regional scene and operate mostly through statute, policy, philosophy, and partnerships. Can you name some regional leaders from your own neck of the woods? In Seattle, I think that Norm Rice is a good leader on the local scene.
John Marty.
Who's that?
John Marty in Minnesota.
What does he do?
He's a senator. He's on the cover of Holy's paper.
Okay. He's a representative from the scene?
He's a state senator.
State senator. Okay.
Well, I have one from Act One.
Okay.
Tony Hall from Dayton.
Okay. Who's that? What does he do?
He's a representative. He's in the House of Representatives, and he was the one who said whites have to apologize for slavery, and his passion is the underfed people in the United States and the world.
Okay. Now, what I'd really like to focus on is Act Three. Act Three leaders really exist everywhere, and I like Act Three leadership, especially if we conceptualize it with a small L. Act Three leaders, I think, work through values and conscience and vision and relationships. When I used to teach in colleges, I used to encourage the undergraduates in my leadership class not to aspire to become Act One or Act Two leaders right away. Take a guess why.
Because it's too easy to be corrupted.
Bingo. It's too easy to be corrupted. One of the things that leaders down here work with is values, and the question I used to ask them is, could they identify one or two leaders in Washington, D.C. who might have co-opted a few values to get where they are now? So how do we act as leaders in our local communities, leadership with a small L, while maintaining a sense of our own integrity? And recognizing that somehow if the spirit is present, that might be enough. Because this is what John Gardner says. John Gardner, the former Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under Kennedy, the founder of Common Cause, the founder of Independent Sector. This is what Gardner says. He's been around for about 85 years observing leadership for probably at least 60 of those. And he says that history meanders like a stream in a valley, and we really can't tell where it's going next. Who would have predicted the fall of the Berlin Wall? Who would have predicted the demise of the Soviet Union? Probably not even the CIA, as I understand it. As a matter of fact, the CIA were surprised that the wall started tumbling down. And he says that because of that, you really never know whether an act of leadership, a small act of leadership at a local level, what if the stream of history crosses your path? It could be that that project, that little event, that person might be thrust into history and into an authentic Act 1 and Act 2 leadership role. Can you name the Act 3 leader in this country who launched the modern-day civil rights movement? Launched it.
Rosa Parks.
Tell us the Rosa Parks story.
She got on the bus. She was a black woman and was told to go sit in the back, and she didn't want to sit in the back, and she started a bus boycott.
Okay, great. Now, it's important to know, too, about Rosa Parks. What we found out since then is that that was not just an innocent act. I mean, that she had received some training, okay? She had gone to something called the Hampton Institute, I believe. That's not quite right. I'll get that fact and share it with you later. But she had gone for some special training about how to get community organizing going. But needless to say, she was still a citizen of Montgomery who had the courage not to leave her seat when told. That resulted in the organization of the bus boycott, and it launched a Act 2 leader, Dr. King, into Act 1 leadership as the press began to observe the boycott. Can you name the Act 3 leader responsible for the resignation of a president in this century? President of the United States. First of all, who's the president?
Nixon.
Who is the Act 3 leader ultimately responsible for the resignation of President Nixon?
Ellsberg.
Daniel Ellsberg actually played a very important role, but prior to Ellsberg.
The journalist who wrote the
Woodward. Okay, Woodward and Bernstein played a very important role, but prior to Woodward and Bernstein.
Deep Throat.
Deep Throat played an essential role, but prior to Deep Throat. John Dean gave some important testimony, but prior to John Dean.
Oh, was it the guy who said that the tapes were there?
Okay, someone said that the tapes actually existed.
The woman that was the secretary that deleted all of them.
Nope.
Jean Gordon Liddy.
No. How about this?
Nixon's wife.
Nixon's wife. That book's not been written yet. We're not sure. How about this? The security guard at the Watergate Hotel. Who found tape on the doors of the Democratic headquarters and had the integrity to tell his boss. It resulted in evidence of the break-in, the cover-up, the formation of the Plumbers Union, the Nixon tapes, and the resignation of a president. By the way, that was an African-American male who worked there, and because of all of the attention given to the Watergate complex, they began to have some less business for a while. And so that person must not have been working for a leader, but a manager, because that African-American was fired. About 2 weeks later, and not only fired, but blackballed from the hotel-motel industry. Okay? This is one of my favorite stories, and I don't know if it's true, but it should be. Okay? And because one of the things that happens in my mind is that this person is now about 65 years old. And one of his favorite things now is when his grandkids come over the house to visit. And they come up and they sit in his lap and they look at him and they say, "Grandpa, will you tell us that story again about how you got rid of the President of the United States?" One more story. Who is Betty Williams? Who is Betty Williams? Betty Williams was a house spouse in Northern Ireland. One day, while she was grocery shopping, she had two bags in her hand. She was walking out of the grocery store and a car bomb went off. And a toddler landed at her feet dead. The tragedy, the horror of violence in Northern Ireland crossed her path that day. She was so moved with anguish, so moved by her own pain, that she went home that evening wondering what to do. What she began to do out of her own pain was to call some friends. And my image is that every phone call, she made about 10 calls, every phone call she made, she wept. And through her tears, the people who didn't witness the bombing all of a sudden experienced the horror of that event. And she asked if those 10 people would join her a week from that day on that spot for a candlelight vigil in honor of that child. Well, she must not have known the passion in her voice. She must not have known the power of her vision, because those 10 people that she called must have called some people. And those people must have called some people, because 1 week later in Northern Ireland, 10,000 women gathered on that spot and had a candlelight vigil in honor of that child. It resulted in a door-to-door knocking campaign, which resulted in the longest succession of violence in Northern Ireland's modern-day history. And in 1979, she won the Nobel Prize for Peace. We're talking about prophetic leadership and what it means to give up the notion of transactional leadership, just playing with the system as it is, and either through speaking the truth in love to power or trying to raise people's hearts to a new level of commitment and understanding and compassion. We're called to prophetic leadership in our faith. So let's stop there. I went over, I know I did. Let's see what discussion we want to have. Yes.
Well, I'd like to talk about somebody that I think is a leader almost in that category that I know who they... May I do that? Or
yes.
Do you not want to do that?
No, that's fine. Whatever we want to do.
The person that I want to talk about is, her name is Doris Ponitz. They've been in Dayton, I'd say, 20 years. Her husband is the president of our community college. And Doris was active with the Philharmonic and the Girl Scouts. And I had a camp for kids from different backgrounds, and she came out to visit my camp. And after that, I had the opportunity to talk to her about my frustration with my son, Will, who has Down syndrome in first grade, and that I didn't think it was going well, and she was willing to share her time. But in this past year, I'm from Dayton, and you know that's where the Peace Accord talks took place. And she took it upon herself to organize a trip to Bosnia for citizens of Dayton. And she and about 20 people went and spent several weeks in Dayton just to see what the needs were.
In Bosnia?
Went to Bosnia, yeah. And then they came back and they gathered things to go over with the second group of people who went to Bosnia. And then they raised $6,000 to bring Bosnians to Dayton. And this summer, Bosnians came to Dayton for either a week or for 2 weeks, and the ones that stayed a week went someplace else for their other week. So this woman has done all that to build on the Peace Accord.
That's wonderful. Please.
Well, what struck me, and it feeds right into what you're talking about too, is the idea of a vision being put to action.
Yeah.
And a lot of us have ideas,
yes,
even visions,
yes,
but don't know how to put them into action or don't lack the courage.
I think that you just named the rub. And Connie, I wanted to also build on your point by going back to something that Brueggemann says, but maybe we can bridge these two. Brueggemann says that the status quo hopes that by our fatness, is what the prophets of old would say. Our satisfaction, our sense of not being hungry, not being worried, not being anxious for our lives, for where we're going to sleep, creates a sense of malaise, I think, that falls over us. So that, you know, necessity is the mother of invention, right? If you had a vision for how something could be different and your children's health and welfare and safety were dependent on it, we'd operationalize that thing in a second, wouldn't we? But what's missing, I think, to your exact point, is the moral motivation. So the question I'd like to ask us is, where do people like Connie's friends in Dayton find the motivation to move from vision to action? Because I think your point is right on, that that's where the rub is. We know, we're capable, we're smart enough, we know what God expects, we know we have visions of a nobler world, one that's more just. But what keeps us from acting? And I just like to revisit this one quote. And what does this mean? The one thing the dominant culture cannot tolerate or co-opt is compassion, the ability to stand in solidarity with the victims of the present order. It can manage charity and good intentions. And I think that's to your point. That the status quo, there's nothing wrong. Let's sit around all day and talk about all the good things we could do for the poor, right? That'll soothe our conscience, that'll make us feel better, but let's make sure that we don't do anything, because it might put me at risk and it might make the status quo upset. So let's talk about it, but let's not do anything.
We could collect some food.
Yeah, right, so long as nothing substantively changed, right? Don Helder Kammerer, a Brazilian priest, said this, "I fed the poor and they called me a saint. I asked why the poor were hungry and they called me a communist." I mean, isn't that the rub? That if you feed the poor, that's one thing. That's just an act of charity. We can manage that. But if we begin to pound our fists and say, wait a minute, isn't hunger despicable? Doesn't racism spit in the face of the gospel? Shouldn't we undo some of these systemic problems that we have in our culture that keep people on the street? 40% of the homeless in Seattle are Vietnam War veterans, suffering from post-traumatic stress syndrome. I think I want to learn your name too.
Me, Kristen.
Kristen. Kristen's point, I think, is right on. So what do we do about that? What prophetic leadership calls us beyond that inertia, into action. How do we get there, folks?
Well, I think you need community. I need you. You need to find people who will listen to you and support you in what you're doing.
Say some more about that, because you, I know you've had some experience in nursing and trying to understand nursing in more of a community context. Can you?
Well, no. I'm thinking more of at a time when I was concerned about the lack of community within my neighborhood. And, well, there's a bit of a story to that. I was praying about this a lot and asking the basic question, if you have a God community, how do you get it?
Yeah.
And finally came up with the answer that seemed so simplistic that it made me almost laugh, and that was people have to talk to each other. So, you know, how do you get people to talk to each other? Well, over a period of time, I thought that art would be a good way.
Art?
The arts.
Okay.
Because it's better to be talking about something in which people can get excited than about something like the terrible crime rate, which kind of leaves you with a dead feeling, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I started saying to some neighbors, what would you think about having a music school in our neighborhood? And I said this to a few people, and I get some nods. But then one neighbor said to me, if you want something, you know, you have to start it. And it was that I needed. You know, I needed to
Great.
Have somebody who would say, here's support for you.
Right. And so the disciples are sent out two by two. That it's difficult work to do on our own.
My understanding is in propaganda that the way it's easier to kill somebody if you can dehumanize them.
Yeah.
So it seemed that the opposite would be true, that if you could put a name and a face
Great.
On a
Great.
Problem, you know, I mean, and you mentioned Vietnam veterans, you know, if you actually knew, you put a name and a face on that.
One of the things I think about is that if your congregation has no one in it let me put it differently. If your congregation, as a congregation, does not know someone who's homeless by name, does not know someone who's unemployed by name, then could it be that you're not in touch? Mm-hmm. And what do you think would happen if your congregation knew someone by name who was hungry?
They wouldn't let them be hungry anymore.
They wouldn't let them be hungry anymore. And so what does it mean to give names? What does it mean to begin to humanize suffering? To begin to humanize pain, getting to know people's names and their stories. Catherine?
In our parish, we have a neighborhood meal, and what our goal is, not necessarily to feed people, but to become friends with people who live in the neighborhood.
Okay.
And the spiritual discipline that several of us in the so-called leadership roles in the community are attempting to make friends, really good friends, with people who are poor. Not a friendship where you are giving to them, but the friendship is where it's a reciprocal relationship, and that you intentionally do things with this person that becomes your friend. And that's how you really start to know a little bit about what it's like to walk in their shoes.
And if I could be mindful of time, I'd like to just sort of end my comments with just two more slides and a reminder. I said, when there was starvation in Goshen, I just absolutely believe that there were people who were motivated by compassion to go to Goshen and to minister to those who were starving. But God sent Moses to Pharaoh. What does it mean to be sent to the seats of power to confront structural change? That knowing the hungry is important, it sensitizes us, it prepares our heart to confront Pharaoh, but it's not enough. What would it mean for your congregation to confront Pharaoh? Your community to confront Pharaoh? And I'd like to offer the words of Robert F. Kennedy to suggest to us what it could mean. If we all set out in our different communities to confront Pharaoh, could it be that it is from these numberless diverse acts of courage and belief that human history is shaped? Each time a person stands up for an ideal or acts to improve the lot of others or strikes out against injustices, she or he sends forth a tiny ripple of hope, and crossing each other from a million centers of energy and daring, these ripples build a current that can sweep down the mightiest walls of oppression and resistance. And until then, as we confront Pharaoh, it's important to remember what Moses did. While waiting for Pharaoh to make up his mind, it's important to know where Moses went to live. Where did he go to live? What's that?
In the palace.
He did? Where did he go after he confronted Pharaoh?
To the wilderness.
He went home and lived with the slaves and made bricks. So until there is justice, let there be solidarity. Until Pharaoh changes his mind, until Pharaoh says, you've caused enough trouble, you know, it's too hard to say no anymore, okay, we'll change things. Until then, who will you be in solidarity with? Who will we be in solidarity with? And I recommend the poor. And the question we have to ask ourselves is, how do we get in solidarity with the poor while at the same time working at confronting Pharaoh for both transformational and transforming change? And I think that's prophetic leadership. Why don't we, it's probably a little over, and Robert, if you want, or Hans, you can end the tape there, but we'll continue the discussion a little bit. And I'm gonna move the projector so I can see people. Dinner is the buffet tonight, right? So that starts at 5,
yes.
And it's pizza. Vegetarian pizza. So Those of you who want to go and get ready for dinner, if you have to meet family members, feel free. Those who want to stay around and kick this around a little bit, let's feel free to do that.
What time is it?
4:30.
4:35.
4:35, which is, I think, when we're supposed to end. Yes?
I just kind of wanted to underline what you were saying that Walter Brueggemann said in his book. I think one thing we can do is to not let ourselves be numb.
Great.
I think of Rumi, mystics, Sufi mystic, who said, has this beautiful poem, there's a refrain that says over and over, don't go back to sleep. You know, I think for me that's the challenge, and especially when I see situations that look overwhelming, not to just numb myself.
You remind me of Hermann Hesse's, you know, novel Siddhartha, there where Siddhartha really begins to mature as a person. His father has been trying to shield him from the fact that there's poor and there's suffering people, and it's only until he sees the first blind person, sees a beggar, he goes, what is that? You know, and his journey of sacredness begins with his encounter with those who suffer.
I don't know about other churches, but I know the ELCA. I think when the ELCA was formed, one of the things they said is that we really want to be a diverse church. Mm-hmm. We want to have diverse peoples. We want to serve everyone. We want to be welcoming to everyone. But because of the American economic system, most often it's people of color who are poor. And that's a generalization of
something. But it's an accurate generalization.
It's true. Now, again, I just talked to someone from Alaska where, guess what's being cut out of the ELCA budget is, when they have to have cuts, is going to be, again, those congregations that are receiving subsidies, most of which are the ones that are serving people of color. Mm-hmm. So I think right in our own backyard, we have a problem.
Yeah, we do.
And we happen to be in a very diverse church, and people of color there, and most of them are poor. Most of them live on Tacoma's Hilltop, not by choice, but because that's the only place they can live. And some of them live there by choice, because that's home.
That's a cultural identity, that neighborhood.
But they don't have a lot of money. And we receive subsidy. And when I talked to the lady from Alaska, I thought, well, it'll hit us probably too, sooner or later. And it comes down to, you think, is the gospel only for those who can pay for it?
Well, let's if we could, as a group, just use that as an example. Let's say that the church is not walking its talk in relation to its commitment to diversity. And that the church, unfortunately, is just as prone to act like the status quo and will attempt to silence you to do something about that. So if we could, let's be your community, your think tank. What are some things that we could do if we were concerned about this issue, that the church is not walking its talk in relation to commitment to churches that are reaching out to diverse populations? Now, money is money, and there's only finite amounts of it. But what could we do to ask the church to walk its talk on cultural issues? What strategies? When, you know, when we think about systemic change, we think of strategies. You know, Moses tried to turn the river a different color. He sent locusts. He had a number of different strategies inspired by God. But it was the strategies, not the moral appeal necessarily to Pharaoh that worked. So what strategies will help? Yes.
I think putting people in touch with those who are poor or those who are victims of injustice. I mean, okay. So you get to know them by name. I think that was mentioned before.
Okay.
We get to know them as brothers and sisters.
Okay. And that that sometimes could take a little bit of time. I've done a lot of work on racial justice over the last 20 years, and I think it's really interesting that this stark difference has really taught me a lot. That when you're able to get blacks and whites in particular to sit down and talk about racial justice, and we get to the point going, okay, you're right, historical mistreatment of blacks is really part of our history, that if we're going to get past this, we really do need to think of some remedies. Let's think creatively about some remedies here. when it gets to that point, which is a huge leap, it takes a lot of work to get there, but when it gets there, there is one more divide that we have to get past. And what I've discovered is that most of the people from majority culture in the room want to know how change is going to happen. And most of the people of color in the room want to know when change is going to happen. So relationships are powerful, but they take time. So if what I found in my own life now, I am 51% committed to when. I am more committed to when than I am how. If I was 99% committed to when and only 1% committed to how, I'd be blowing up buildings. Okay. But I'm 51% committed to how, to when, and 49% committed to how, so I'm committed to collaborative problem solving, but absolutely committed to when. So with some pressure of when, what strategies can we help with? Connie?
Well, I think one way to get the message out is to use publicity channels, either newspapers or is there radio, TV, that publicize this information.
So bring some public notice to bear. Try to bring some public attention to the pain and anguish. That was the secret of the civil rights movement. Watching innocent people getting clubbed by walking across a bridge. That innocent suffering brought great, great power to the civil rights movement. That's a great point, yes.
The notion that could be extremely unpopular would be that the congregations in the area, basically the synod or region, who know each other. I mean, we know the Alaska churches and the Washington church. Could decide to withhold their contributions to the ELCA until the ELCA changed its mind.
Yeah, that's a very powerful approach, going, you know, before we give you our money, we have a question about stewardship of our money. That's a very powerful
approach. That's a solidarity kind of a thing.
It is a solidarity kind of thing. Sandy, you had a hand up and I missed you.
No, I'm off there.
Okay,
I'm
sorry.
Just writing letters do any good? Write letters to the keys of power in Chicago, or having resolutions from our synod to remember these congregations?
Absolutely. And what I think is really powerful is the telephone. You know, if you came from a congregation, let's just say of 200 people, and if every one of those persons agreed to make a phone call within the same week, do you think that would, you know, can you imagine 200, one of those little message slips on your desk going, we're concerned about, you know, I mean, that's what makes a difference. What would happen if 200 people were to call the office and say, we're concerned about this question? All of a sudden, I tell you, if there was a staff meeting the next day, I know that that item is on the agenda and probably at the top at that point, okay? So you've drawn moral attention to something. Yes?
Another, it's kind of an inverse of withholding the money, and that is congregations uniting to raise money for that particular thing and just saying,
okay,
here's the money, we want that church.
So the pie is not finite, let's expand the pie, okay? Solve it through generosity, not just through the redistribution of limited resources. Because, you know, all organizations are challenged to how to divide the pie.
Organizing sister parishes, those who have
great
more money, adopting on
great one-on-one stuff. We're in this together. Anyone else? Am I missing hands upstairs? In the back.
Sister parishes, we've done that with an African-American congregation in the city, but it is hard to get to the level of where you deal with the problem.
Right. Yeah, it's,
and we've been stuck on that, and we haven't gotten beyond, really. We've made close friends, but as far as a lot of that of their congregation is wondering, what are we in it? You know, what's our motive?
Yeah, is it just about sharing choirs?
Right.
Nothing wrong with sharing choirs.
Exchanges, potlucks.
But is there something of substance beyond that we can work on together?
And we haven't done that.
I think I really encourage you to keep it up, though. I really believe in parish partnerships as a long-term strategy. We just need short-term strategies to accompany them. But I think parish partnerships are a really powerful form. And the fact that you've kept it going over a number of years is no small thing. So congratulations on that. Connie?
how do you elect people to decision-making positions who are like-minded?
Yeah.
Encourage candidates that you trust to run, first of all. Holland, is there
anything? I think the thing I would want to share is that it's very easy for the system to be so complex and so directed in so many different directions that it's
right.
That the churches in the Seward Peninsula in Alaska are so far away from us. And we're concentrating on other things,
right.
either personally, our own church, or whatever, that the energy level to mm-hmm. really work on that and actually pursue it is very, I mean, perhaps this is very critical, but when you think of the last 10, no, think of the last four or five conventions of our national church, every one of our churches, every one of our conventions it has no central focus that has gone through all of them. There's been a focus, and then we drop that, and then we focus on something else. And so we've lost track somewhere along the line of the initial idea that we were going to be an inclusive church, and then we were going to focus on the poor and bringing it, you know. That was 10 years ago. Today it's working with ecumenical relationships. What will it be
next year? 2 years.
2 years from now. But all of our, and so we don't, somehow, the complexity of our society, I think, is a negative factor here that simply diverts us from being prophetic in our leadership. And I don't know. I just share that for what it's worth.
I think it's a very powerful
statement. It bothers me that, you know, that these congregations are going to get lost in all this shuffle.
And what I really believe here, and that's why I'm interested in collaborative solving, problem solving, is that the corporate sector has a great deal to teach the church. Is the corporate sector knows how to take visions and turn them into business plans. You know, you don't make money thinking about making toasters. Or you don't make money when you start out to make toasters and all of a sudden you go, hey, snowboards are a good idea. You know, that doesn't make it. Corporations know how to focus on toasters.
They also know that when you put a new product on the shelf, you take another product off the shelf, and that's a huge decision-making process.
And so, to be honest, we have leaders of corporations in our churches, right? What would it mean? Jesus said, if only the children of light were as smart as the children of darkness. And I'm not suggesting that corporations are the children of darkness, but I'm suggesting, why can't we carry strategic planning and that sort of focused attempt to do change into the churches? It's not all up to the Spirit. We have to have plans, you know. I have friends, you know, in the Midwest who say, it's okay to pray for a good harvest, but keep plowing, you know. Or the friends in Seattle will say, you know, it's okay to pray for safe sailing, but steer away from the rocks. You know, it's a lot of it is up to us. And I really believe in a laser focus. If you took all the light in this room and left it as diffused as it is now, it's sufficient for reading, it's sufficient for, you know, us not stumbling into chairs on the way out. But if you were to take all of this light in this room and focus it through a ruby crystal, what do you have then?
Powerful beam.
That could cut a new door in that wall, only because it's focused. Okay? And so I think your point is essential to transformational change. And if you and look at these movements, I mean, it would behoove us to study the civil rights movement. It was not an accident. It was a strategy. I mean, it was Dr. King was a powerful, powerful strategist. Up to and including things like, let's talk about freedom in the shadow of the Lincoln Memorial. Okay, I know we gotta go, but those of you who need to go, feel free, we'll just chat till we hear the bell maybe.
I have a question. Where is the anguish in the Lutheran Church?
I think that should be the title of the next national conference.
I'm not in the Lutheran Church anymore because I had trouble finding the anguish.
Dan, I wonder, something just occurred to me. I want to ask Dan Coleman a question. What role could the arts play, and music in particular, in helping us to get in touch with the anguish of our day? And, you know, are we doing enough around that in the churches?
Well, I don't think we're doing enough. We're certainly not doing enough in our church, but we are starting a charitable concert series at our church where we're going to involve, for the initial concert, we're going to involve just the musical groups within our church. It's not a huge church, but we have an adult choir, two kids' choir, and a bell choir, and then we're going to also invite people from the community in to do benefit. Every concert we do is going to be a benefit.
Wonderful.
Where we'll probably have some expenses because some of the people we bring in will have to be paid something. But we're calling it the Bethel Charitable Concert Series, and we're always going to pinpoint some specific events where the money can go and have like five concerts a year to do that. That's something that comes to mind just because we're in the process of planning it. But music itself, I think texts need to speak more. I mean, there is music out there, but we don't do much of it at our church, frankly. And if you look through the hymnal, it's the LBW anyway, and I don't know Whitland voice really well, but if you look through the LBW, there's just really a few hymns like Lord is Love on the Service and a couple that speak specifically about justice issues, and the rest are some good hymns and some good messages, but not a lot to do with that. So I think there needs to be more text written in that area.
I think that the arts have a great potential, and they're maybe starting to be used more now. Liturgical dance. boy, it'd be nice to see somehow to integrate visual arts. I think of artists like Kate, what was her name, a German, she did prints and just anguish in them, you know, of people just being anguished. I think the more open congregations can be to, oh, I was going to mention theater too. Just the other night they did the improvisational play, and at the end they did the story of Amos. And had someone act out just what we're talking about, the anguish of, you know, what? How can you be feasting and celebrating and holding hilarity when there's this, you know, people starving, and bringing it right to focus, and people were right on the edge of their seats, listening and waiting for the answer.
And that's the person who did that is our, been our Bible study leader, who's just been some terrific Bible studies. If you've not been to them, he'll begin his work again on Monday mornings. Yes.
I was thinking too that one of the things our church has gotten involved in the last few years is the Habitat for Humanity program. And there's an excellent leadership out somewhat outside of the church, and yet the church can move into that and kind of tap into that and use a lot of its own people to develop on the level of the church. You know, it's still utilizing much of their vision and kind of tag on to that.
And if I could build on that as an example of what I would love to see more of in all of our service projects, and I think Habitat for Humanity is among the best. I mean, getting out there and banging nails and putting up the doors and, you know, and raising the rafters. I mean, that's about as clear as it gets in terms of service. And the future homeowners working together
side
to improve with some sweat equity.
Yeah.
What I would love is is there a sense, this is an obvious question, I bet there is a sense of camaraderie. After you imagine taking that sense of camaraderie back to a church and have a candlelight soup dinner, simple soup, good bread, good soup, super dinner, and say, boy, it sure felt good to build a house. Why do you think there are so many people without homes in this country? You know, that sort of becomes, you know, when I fed the poor, they called me a saint. When I asked, you know, why they were hungry, they called me a communist. You risk something there by having that conversation. But it also moves it from an act of very powerful charity to to an act of justice.
I'm going to say something about what I think one of the things that strikes me sometimes is to see how alienated some people are from the poor.
Yeah.
So I think when they have good intentions about the poor, they think in abstract. And they think in what would be good for them, in a very paternalistic way. So I guess what our church needs to do is to hear the poor, and is to listen to them, and to bring them in a scene, and not think on them like in abstract, like in what is good for them, or what we think from our good intentions, or our studies, or those kind of things. And perhaps there, in that encounter, there is redemption and a new way to see the other one and to live with the other one.
I'd like to, it was the dinner bell, end with that comment, but just say this briefly. In this book that the ALCA has just put out about economic justice, they suggest that you take a look at the incomes in your congregation, those above 80,000, those between 50 and 80, those between 30 and 50, you get it. Those under 20,000, those under 15,000, those under 10,000, those families exist in this country, and essentially take the census data of the poor, what are they earning for a yearly income, and then ask yourself, how many people in those brackets are members of your church? And would it be in your best interest, to Marcelo's point, to, if you don't have that represented in your congregation, to do whatever you can in the next year to ensure that representation. And then it's not about abstract, it's about real relationships. And that changes all of us. Okay? Thanks a lot. Let's have dinner.